It's the ninth month of a notable year, an interesting time to be alive. Thank you for lending your ears and a helping hand during our membership drive. This is where the arts and culture of West Wisconsin flocks and yaks. Although I don't think a group of yaks is called a flock. Anyway, thanks for finding a place in the audience. I'm Al Ross, and this week, in addition to asking for your support during our fall member drive, we're going to celebrate our good fortune of having friends like you better than ever during difficult times by featuring some garage dialogue with the one and only Billy Krause. Music takes a different form when it comes to Nick Phillips, professor of piano at UW Eau Claire and conveyor of details on the First Friday's concerts from Pablo Center in Eau Claire. He too is a Swest guest this week. That's my new shortcut for our name, Swest. S-apostrophe-S, you see. I kind of like it. Anyway, number two. Let's take our weekly plunge, beginning with this. As the promotional announcements said, only in Wisconsin could a book about cheese merit a second edition. Jerry Apps puts the his in history, especially about his home state. And the second edition of Cheese, the Making of a Wisconsin Tradition, is his latest in a long line of books about who we are and how we do things around here. I reached Jerry on Monday at his home in southern Wisconsin. Well, if one grows up in Wisconsin, one is aware of cheese. The preface of the book must have been a bit of a project there, Jerry, making sure that you had everyone acknowledged. Wow.
Well, a lot of people helped me with this project because it's very important to our state. It's one of the premier aspects of our agricultural situation, and it has a most interesting history, which I tried to pull out in my book. I wrote the first edition in 1998.
Hmm.
Well, it seemed like it would be a good idea to bring it up to date. Sure. Little did I know that in 20 years, so much has happened with farming, yeah. Dairy farming in particular, yeah. And in the cheese industry. So I tried to capture as much of that as I could manage in this new book.
You succeeded. And I was going to ask you at the outset what the second edition has that the first didn't, but I think throughout the course of our discussion, we'll discover what that is. I don't believe I remember my first visit to a cheese factory, but you do.
Yeah, I grew up on a small dairy farm, as many people know, in just west of Wild Rose, Wisconsin. We had a little cheese factory in Wild Rose. I tell the story in the book about the days, and I often did this, go with my dad to the mill to grind feed for our cattle, and the cheese factory was just across the road. So sometimes we would walk across the road to the cheese factory, and I was just amazed at what was going on there, because that was so different from anything that I had experienced on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
Here are these guys all wearing white clothing. That seemed a little weird to me right off the bat. But also, there was these great big tanks of milk. And I was just a little kid then, I don't know, 8-10 years old. And they offered me some curd. I tell you, that's the first time I had an experience with squeaky curd.
Ooh.
I've never forgotten it. Well, that was my early personal introduction to the cheese-making industry.
A lot of people think cheese curds are cheese curds, but it is paramount, if possible, to get them while they're still squeaky, isn't it?
That's right. The sooner the better. And a little interesting aside, my mother used to recite, "Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet, eating her curds and whey." And what was going on, I now know. Little Miss Muffet's mother or somebody else was making cheese.
Yeah.
That's it. Cheese has two byproducts.
Yeah, but you notice in that little rhyme, there's nothing about the word squeaky.
That's true.
And if there was, then Little Miss Muffet would have been really happy.
The squeaky part doesn't rhyme very well with the rest of it.
Yeah, what can you rhyme? Leaky? I don't think so. Why?
Right.
Why would we do that? The part I liked when you were describing your visit to the cheese factory, you were noticing the guys in their trucks and the milk cans and the steel roller conveyor.
Right.
That they were putting the milk cans on. I don't remember it from a cheese factory, but I remember it when my dad used to go to, it was a liquor store, but they called it the beer depot. They used to put their empty cases of beer on a roller like that, and my brother and I used to sit and just watch them go by, you know, right through the wall. How cool is that?
Yeah, well, that's what this was. And, of course, the milk cans were 10 gallons, and everybody had his own number. I still remember it. Our number was 424.
No kidding.
It was painted on the outside of each can. And as you said, the milk hauler, we call him the milkman, and when I was talking to an urban crowd one time, they just couldn't fathom, I didn't explain it very well, that the milkman didn't deliver milk, but he picked up milk.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Well, anyway, with these cans on the roller into the cheese factory, and then somebody there would dump them. But that wasn't all of it. The cans then went to a mechanical can washer to clean them up, and then they came out on the other end, and the milk hauler who brought the cans in filled with milk took them back in his truck. It was a very interesting time. It's very different today.
And now the big truck shows up and pumps it out of your tank, right?
Well, that's true. In fact, today, the larger dairies, the milk goes straight from the milking parlor into the truck, into the tank.
Wow. Well, for a long time, as we have probably established already, cheese was cheese and cheese making was cheese making. But times have changed, and I think over the course of the next few minutes, we're going to talk about some of those changes. I have a good friend, Jerry, who has a new young yellow lab, and he named him Cheddar.
So, how about that?
So at least in some circles, Cheddar is still getting some respect. But like Swiss, it's not our favorite anymore, is it?
Well, it's close.
I'm not cool because aged Cheddar and Swiss are still two of my favorites.
For me as well. But it was not very long ago, only a couple of years ago, that mozzarella cheese became the most popular cheese in Wisconsin, the most popular cheese produced in Wisconsin.
We attribute that to pizza, right?
Yeah, exactly. And cheddar slipped into second place. But we still make a lot of cheddar. If you have cheeseburgers, all that kind of stuff, that tends to be cheddar cheese.
As I was reading, I thought, you know, it's similar to when I was a kid. We used to sit on the curb with my buddies, and we would name cars and models as they drove by. And it was easy because there weren't very many. Today, it's a lot different, and so is the selection of cheeses.
To just capture the idea of the number of different cheeses, people just almost fall off their chairs when I tell them that we in Wisconsin now make 600 different kinds of cheeses. 600. That's one of the big changes that has occurred in the last 20 years with the development of specialty cheeses. Cheddar might be the base cheese, but then there's cheddar with cranberries and cheddar with strawberries and so on.
Sure.
And each one of those becomes a specialty cheese. And maybe I'm exaggerating when I say this, but in many ways, saving the cheese industry is not the right way to say it because the cheese industry has been doing well.
Sure.
But it really enhanced it. More people today are eating cheese, I think, than ever before, and more of it.
I was thinking about wine and cheese parties, and of course, there's lots more wines, so you got to have more cheeses.
Exactly. It's the same category. And I also wrote the history of beer making in Wisconsin, as you know, breweries of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm,
and the craft breweries are comparable to the specialty cheeses.
Beer cheese soup, too. There you go.
Yeah, really.
Oh, wow. On the phone with Jerry Apps, you know him. He's written a lot of books, and they're all wonderful. The one we're talking about is Cheese, The Making of a Wisconsin Tradition, the second edition. There is, I discovered in my research, a cheese.com website. It would be kind of cool to have that domain. On it, there are blogs about cheese. Wouldn't blog be a good name for a cheese?
Probably.
Oh, maybe. And on the website, one discovers that not only is cheese made from the milk of cows, but also sheep, goats, buffalo, reindeer, camels, and yaks.
Just about any animal that milks, they're making cheese from it.
Wow.
But just to add to that, a note, Wisconsin is the leading manufacturer of goat cheese in the nation.
Hmm.
And we also have the largest number of dairy goats in the nation. So I have a whole section in my book about goat dairies and goat cheese making.
Sure. I ran across one of those factories on a road trip down in the Driftless area around Mount Sterling and that area.
Yeah, that's it. Mount Sterling was one of the early goat cheese factories. That is correct. Yeah.
It's good.
It has a very different taste. Some people can't handle that.
Mm-hmm.
It's different, and it's well, goats don't eat as much. The manure problem is not as great.
Sure.
It's dairy. It's a growing area. Oh, and another thing about goat cheese is, for those people who are lactose intolerant, mm-hmm. and we have a fair number of people who have that problem, goat cheese is an answer, more easily digested. Same thing with sheep cheese.
But I got to tell you, when I was a kid, we were led to believe that goats would eat anything. Goats would eat tin cans. But
you know, I had the same story. And have you ever seen a goat eat a tin can?
No.
I have not.
No.
Nobody else has either.
No, I guess that was a myth. But
yeah.
It was fun to believe. Wow, good digestive system there. What I found surprising in the book, and I don't know why, you would think that it was relative to the existence of dairy farms, but the existence of cheese factories is actually booming, and our per capita consumption has literally tripled in the past 50 years.
Exactly. That's absolutely right. And the number of dairy farms has dwindled down to a precious few. And every year, well, every week almost, we're losing dairy farms. Let's see, I have the numbers here. In 1939, when I was a youngster,
mm-hmm.
we had 160,000 dairy farms in Wisconsin.
Wow.
And in 1950, that dwindled down to 143,000. And let me jump way ahead. To 1997, we had 25,000 dairy farms.
Wow.
And hold your breath now. In 2020, right now, 7,049.
Which still seems like a lot, but I guess it's not.
Well, compared to 160,000,
no,
7,000 is not very many. When I was a kid on the farm, every one of our neighbors had a small dairy herd. Well, we didn't have electricity until 1947, and so we were milking cows by hand. And if you're milking cows by hand, 14, 15, 16 cows, people falling off their chairs laughing when I say that was the size of a dairy herd, but it was.
Yeah, sure.
And that was the true of all of our neighbors. Well, mm-hmm. now, and I still have a farm a couple of miles from where I grew up, that whole neighborhood, there's not one dairy farm left.
Too bad. We, as you might expect, export cheese, and the top two importers of Wisconsin cheese are directly to the south and to the north of us.
Yeah, Mexico and Canada, which is wonderful. And we export the vast majority of the cheese, of course. We can't eat as much cheese as we produce. It's 3-something billion pounds of cheese that we make in Wisconsin. It's a huge, huge amount. Here it is. And these figures are a little old, 2017. 3.4 billion pounds of cheese. And as recently as 1998, it was 2.1 billion pounds.
Mm-hmm.
So we are on a cheese-making roll.
Still focusing on the changes in the industry, the process where milk comes from, we've alluded to it a bit, dairy operations are simply larger today, and that's larger with all caps. And cheesemakers themselves cite things like more variety. We've already hit on more artisan cheeses, and you brought up the 600 number. Wow. Collaboration between makers I found interesting. And along the way somewhere, and I think this has cooled off a little bit, but California kind of shoved its way into the dairy discussion.
You know, I've got that too. It was in 1995,
okay.
I believe that number is correct. Yes. In 1995, California became the leading milk producer in the nation.
Okay.
Wisconsin, starting in 1910, when it took away from New York State the first in cheese production, Wisconsin has remained the leader in cheese production from 1910 to the present moment.
Oh,
no matter what you want to say about California, and there are all kinds of things you can say about them, they still produce more milk than we do, not all that much more, but they
mm-hmm.
do. But they are behind us when it comes to cheese production. It's still appropriate to have on our license plate America's Dairyland.
Yes. Different kinds of people are also getting into cheese making. It's not that you have to have roots in the process, I guess.
Well, in fact, let me just share a little history, which I think is kind of interesting.
Okay.
The early cheesemakers, going back, way back to the middle 1800s. The cheesemakers, by and large, were women in their farm kitchen. The idea of a cheese factory was still a foreign idea here in Wisconsin. There were some cheese factories operating in New York State. But it took a long time for Wisconsin's men to realize that men could take care of dairy cows and men could make cheese. Doesn't that sound weird?
It does.
And so, but the men, to do it, they said, we're not going to do it in the kitchen, for heaven's sakes. We're going to build a separate building someplace so we can make our cheese in a cheese factory. And they did that. Well, then it just flipped. And the idea was, well, unless you're a man, you can't make cheese in a cheese factory. So there were a handful of women that were working in the factories making cheese. I find that just a fascinating idea,
that
really
is. That's very cool. And I also like the way you already have a low voice, but I like the way you lower it when you're going, men. You know, that's good stuff. So, you know, other things that have affected the industry are renewable energy and conservation, and a big one is the organic movement.
Organic Valley is the largest producer of organic cheese in the country, and the interest in organic cheese continues, as well as other organic dairy products. The organic cheese movement is one that's very important. I could add this, too. The different ethnic groups that settled in Wisconsin, many of them brought along with them their own idea for cheese, especially the Italians. Pizza cheese, mozzarella is an Italian cheese. There are a whole bunch of them. And I should say this, too. Wisconsin has two cheeses people here invented, and it's Colby, a little cheese factory up in near Colby, Wisconsin, and then it's Brick cheese. Which was invented by a cheese factory in Dodge County. And those two cheeses are authentic, historical, made only in Wisconsin in the early days cheeses. I think that's kind of interesting, too.
We should have that on a license plate. Don't you think? We can't get into this simply because it's just too pronounced, the effect that technology has had on cheese making. It's pretty huge nowadays. I don't want to take too much more of your time. Jerry Apps with us. We're talking about cheese and his second edition book called Cheese, The Making of a Wisconsin Tradition. Jerry, you're noted for doing your research. This book seems to be demanding in that category. The end of the book, lots of notes and an extensive bibliography. Speaking of the end of the book, there is a three-paragraph last word, it's called, but in a nutshell, I'm wondering if you reached any astute conclusions by writing this book, and what words of cheesedom do you want to leave us with?
For those who have some question about, well, what about cheese and where is all this going, the last words I have is, I think the cheese industry is going to continue. We have some of the most skilled cheesemakers in the world. You only have to look at the national and international cheese contests. Many, many of the awards are won by Wisconsin people. So I see a bright future, especially as the cheese makers keep trying new things. They're not stuck in their histories. It's easy to be stuck in the past. The history is very important, but there's certain parts of it that one leaves behind. As you move forward, you build on it, to be sure. You build on your history. You build on your ancestors who made cheese and made it well. That's an important foundation. But then you keep nuancing it. You keep looking for new things. And all of a sudden, you have 600 different kinds of cheeses. And by 10 years more, we're going to have another 200-300.
So much cheese, so little time.
Right.
Wow. Jerry Apps, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for taking time with us here on WPR and Spectrum West. Send us all your books. Thanks.
Appreciate the opportunity.
A very genuine chat with writer and singer of songs, Billy Krause, coming up. And next, a look at the music of First Fridays. This is Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Pablo Center at the Confluence, celebrating the United Nations International Day of Peace today, September 24th, with a live stream hosted by the Coalition for Nonviolence. Open admission, pablocenter.org. Hey, you guys, we're in our fall membership drive, a time we ask you to consider how important the Ideas Network is to your life, the programs you rely on for news and information, but also the interesting guests and conversations, entertainment and entertainers, and the perspective you get from programs like Spectrum West. We're your neighbors, and around here, neighbors help each other. We're proud to be listener-supported. Your gift of any amount makes a difference at 888-202-2552 or at WPR.org. Thanks a lot. First Friday's concerts were born at the same time the Pablo Center took its first steps. Informal gatherings to watch and hear UW Eau Claire faculty prove again why they're trusted with next generations of musicians. Our gatherings are a bit different in this pandemic age, but we can still watch and we can still hear. I called one of the organizers, pianist Nicholas Phillips, for specifics. For those out there saying, Nick Phillips, who's he? Who are you?
Well, I teach piano here at UW Eau Claire on faculty since 2007. What else about me? I'm very active as a pianist, performing solo concerts and also collaborative concerts here in town and all over the country and abroad.
Yeah. You don't have to go into anything personal. That's just okay. So what is life like as a music teacher these days? I'll bet the pianos are cleaner than they've ever been.
Yeah, that's true. In some ways, although we all know that the piano is the best instrument to begin with. Of course.
There you go. Sure.
But, you know, in some ways, we're very fortunate because unlike some of my colleagues who, you know, play wind instrument or who sing, who are dubbed these super spreaders because they're producing aerosols.
Sure.
As pianists, we're quite safe as long as we're washing our hands and disinfecting keys and teaching music. I'm able to teach my students in person in my office. We're both masked, air purifiers, and then I wipe the keys down and have the students clean their hands before each lesson.
Okay.
So life is different in general, but for me as a piano teacher, I feel quite fortunate to be back in person with my students.
Yeah. As I've told most people, it doesn't matter what walk of life they're in. When this is all over, everything we do is going to seem so easy.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, some things will perhaps never be quite the same, at least for a generation. But yeah, it's sure going to be nice when we can get back to normal.
You bet. You mentioned the word students. Who are your students? Are they music majors? Are they piano majors? Music education majors? They have to learn all the instruments.
Yeah, in our department, everyone has to take piano to some extent, whether that's class piano to prepare for an exam or their degree requires piano. So I have a combination of students. I have piano performance majors. I have composition students who are primarily pianists. I have music ed students who are primarily pianists. But then I also have students who are in other degrees that require piano, like choral education majors or vocal performance majors have a requirement to take piano. So I have an assortment of piano majors, music majors, music minors, and occasionally I'll have a student who's not a major who is able to take elective lessons.
You've recorded some CDs, of course. We've had them on the show. You've been doing any of that lately?
The last CD I think we talked about, Shift, was the last one that I recorded. And no, I don't have any in the pipeline at the moment. I've been doing more concerts and chamber music and focusing on projects like that. I don't have any recordings in the works.
Okay, but you'll let us know when you do.
Always, yeah. It's kind of addictive to get in the studio and make more recordings.
And we love them. On the phone with Nicholas Phillips. He is a piano professor, as he outlined, and we're talking, well, not yet, but after I say this, First Friday's concerts. The next 3 months, we've already had one, and they're from the Jamf Theater, Pablo Center, and we'll give you all the details in just a bit. A short history of the First Friday's concerts, beginning with a very recent history. You had a September 4th event, and I heard it was exceptional.
September 4th was flutist Brian Allred, and he gave a great program of unaccompanied flute pieces, live-streamed, as you said, from Jamf. brief history of the series usually takes place in the Clearwater Room, kind of a nice intimate room on the third floor, and we've done a combination of solo and chamber music events in that room. It seats about 125 people if they're crammed in there real tight, which of course we can't do right now.
That's right.
The series has been around since the opening of the Pablo, so we're in our third season as well. We've curated a number of interesting concerts that are really be attractive to the Eau Claire audience. And in fact, this fall, for sure, while they're online, you know, anyone around the world can buy a ticket to these concerts and listen to them, which is kind of nice.
The musicians who partake of these First Friday, are they all teachers? Are there some students? Are there guests? A combination of all?
They're faculty, yeah, music faculty.
They are.
There is a concert in February with Alistair Wright, who's a saxophonist, and he'll be joined by Roger Bethard at the piano. So Roger's not on faculty, but we'll play the concert with him. But it's all music faculty from Eau Claire.
Okay. So we talked about the September 4th event. You have three remaining, October 2nd, November 6th, and December 4th. The October 2nd one, that's easy to describe, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. That's just me. I'll be sitting at the piano in jam that Friday night, live streaming that concert. The pieces that I'm playing are five piano miniatures by Fanny Hensel, whose maiden name was Mendelssohn, and listeners probably know the music of her brother, Felix Mendelssohn. Fanny was, in her own right, an incredibly accomplished pianist and composer. So I'm playing a set of five miniatures of hers that are virtuosic and slow and tender and lyrical. Some really nice music I look forward to sharing with the audience. And paired with that is the final sonata by Franz Schubert. It's just a glorious piece of music, a large-scale four-movement sonata. I always tell my students that we celebrate Schubert's heavenly length. It's about a 40-minute piece, which is kind of symphonic in nature. Just an exquisite piece of music, the kind of piece you listen to and don't even realize how long it's been since you started it.
Well, that's good. So that's Friday, October 2nd. And without going into too much detail, because hopefully we can talk to you prior to each one of these, briefly, what's coming up on November 6th?
Both November and December are going to be chamber music primarily, and these will be pre-recorded so that the performers can all safely play inside with each other.
Cool.
And then the video will be one live stream link on Friday. The November concert is called British Music from Byrd to Britain. William Byrd was a Renaissance composer, and Benjamin Britten was a very famous 20th century composer. It's saxophone, voice, guitar, clarinet, and piano.
And then it's a birthday party in December.
That's right. The world was going to be inundated with the Beethoven 250th year. You know, he was born in 1770, so this is celebrating his 250th birthday. So many of those concerts were canceled or changed format with the pandemic, but we're excited to give a song cycle of his. Nobu Yasuda will join me to play the Spring Sonata for violin and piano, and Mark Mowry will sing, and Julie DeBoer will sing, and I'm also going to play his sonata for piano, Opus 57, the Appassionata, that one's called.
All right. The mention of tickets included three varies in describing how inexpensive they are. How do we get what we need to view this stuff?
The tickets are incredibly cheap. After tax, it's going to set you back $2.64.
No.
For my concert, that's a little over 4 cents a minute of music. So it's a pretty good bargain. You go to the Pablo's website, pablocenter.org. You can navigate to their calendar of events, and then you'll click on the date. There will be a link there to buy your ticket. There's also an option with each ticket to donate to the Pablo Center as well.
Good idea. You are one of many reasons the arts are still in our front row, even during a global pandemic. Nicholas Phillips, always a pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Al.
Coming up next on the menu, sitting in the garage on a beautiful early afternoon with none other than Mr. Billy Krause on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Charter Bank, a locally owned community bank now offering checking accounts. Charter Bank is dedicated to being invested in the community, customers, and employees. More information is at charterbank.bank. As you may know, this is our fall membership drive, and here's an invitation and an appeal to cast a positive vote for WPR with your pledge of a contribution, whatever you think it's worth to you to maintain, to assure that you'll be able to continue discovering new things every day. From the latest worldwide information to ideas for better living, and in the case of Spectrum West, conversations with people who enhance our lives through art, literature, music, and culture. Your pledge of any amount is appreciated online at WPR.org or by phone at 888-202-2552. Thank you, thank you, thank you. When it comes to musicians and writers of songs, the likes of which we have our share in West Wisconsin, there's only one, Billy Krause. His music is as much who he is as that gleam in his eye and the fingers on the strings. His music is about what he's seen and done, where he comes from, and with whom he likes to spend his time.
Summer's August sanctuary, Chippewa River tributary. Sneak away to catch the birds. If mama asks, don't breathe a word. In the sun along the beams, that's where they like to lay.
Billy and I took a load off on lawn chairs in his garage the other day. A chat with a guy like Billy can do a lot for a day. And it turns out he had some important things to say to friends and family. Well, we're both old enough to remember This Is Your Life.
Oh.
So in the same way that you played Van Morrison a couple of years ago in the last waltz commemoration, I'm going to play the part of Ralph Edwards.
You even resemble him a little bit.
Sixth grade, first guitar, a Kent. I looked up Kent guitars. I find Kent guitars, but was it just a little acoustic?
A little acoustic, yeah. Nylon strings. I had enough money left over that I saved from mowing lawns. I had enough money left over to buy Mel Bay's Book of Chords. I think there's a lot of guitarists out there that are graduates of the Mel Bay School of Music.
You saw beatniks on TV, and you wanted to do that.
We used to spend our summers at they call it a lake home now, but it was a cottage up on Pine Harbor on Lake Wasota. And we were out swimming, and my dad hollered out the door. He says, "Get in here, there's some beatniks on TV." I went in the house, and it was, I believe, the national debut of Peter, Paul, and Mary, their performance on the Today Show. And I watched them do If I Had a Hammer, of course, was their big hit. That was it. I says, I want to do that.
And then you were inspired and you wrote Dirty Hands.
Dirty Hands. Jeez, you did go back. You did go back in an old interview.
Dirty Hands.
Dirty Hands. Only Dirty Hands.
That's a classic title.
Yeah. Boy, I can't remember any of that one. A friend of mine, singer-songwriter from the East Coast, Michael Jeerling. I'm sure you're familiar with Michael. I saw him down at the university at the cabin years ago. And he played a song called I'm a Kite. It's one of those songs to him like Dirty Hands is to me. And I asked him one time, I says, "You going to play I'm a Kite tonight? You remember that?" I said, "Yeah, I'm a Kite. I've got four corners." We all have those little starting points in music.
So then a garage band. You had a Silvertone guitar and a K-amp.
I got that.
The Ravens.
The Ravens. I got that K-amp. My father said he'd buy the guitar for me. So we're going to go down Saturday. I believe Sears sold Silvertone. So we'll go in a few minutes. He says, "Go up and wait in the car and I'll be up." So I sat in that car. I sat in the car 45 minutes, hour. Got sick of waiting and I opened the car door and I ran down the steps to the house, opened the screen door, and there's that guitar was sitting leaning against the wall. Well, I blew the speaker on the amp within a week. So it was always distorted.
And then came the exceptions. Give us the slogan.
There are bands and there are bands and then there are the exceptions.
Oh, man. That could have got you places.
Yeah. But, yeah, we played a couple of Y dances. And
you guys used to love bouncing between music stores until you got booted out.
Oh, we do that. Torgerson Music and Piano on North Barstow. That's all torn down, of course. I guess his name was Olaf Torgerson, something like that.
What nationality would that be?
Yeah. We'd sit down there and play and then get kicked out of there and ride our bikes up to Morgan Music and Morgan's never kicked us out. I ended up working for a little while for Bud back when I was in high school.
And then you auditioned for Carl at Fernier's with Eight Penny Opera.
We thought it sounded cool.
Who cares?
Yeah.
Or you were booked on some Friday nights there.
Friday night a month for a year, yeah.
Even when you weren't playing at Fernier's, on your Friday nights, you had this system.
Fernier's teen dances always got done at, I believe, 11 o'clock. I walk across the Grand Avenue Bridge, get on Graham Avenue. The first club was the Diamond Lounge, which is, I believe, the firehouse now. And you could walk in the back door and watch them for a while. The next bar was the Back 40, and that was a basement bar. And you'd walk into the Back 40, and there was a landing, and you could see the stage. Walk in there, watch them play for a while, and then cross the river to Shara's Wagon Wheel. And their stage was in the window. And then walk down Galloway to the footbridge and cross it and go home.
Now, the part of your past that I wasn't aware of was your travels along the East Coast and sleeping in Goodwill bins. I thought, wow, what a guy. This is this is Woody Guthrie type stuff.
Well, it was out of necessity. My best buddy, he's passed on now, but was 2 years older than me, enlisted in the service right away, was stationed out of New London, Connecticut, on a submarine. And so I hitchhiked out there to spend some time with him and hang out and drink beer and raise a little cane. And I also knew a friend that lived in Boston. So I went out there first, and I learned from experience find places to sleep, because the Goodwill boxes had a great big square on them. Throw my knapsack and guitar in there and spend the night. You had to take everything with you every day, you know. Otherwise, you never knew when they were going to empty out. Played as a street musician down in the Boston Commons for a while.
A busker.
Busker, yeah. My mother got ill with cancer, ironically. So I started hitchhiking back, and I got caught in Syracuse, New York on the ramp in just a thunderstorm, just a pouring rain. And these two figures come walking up the ramp. I thought, oh boy, I'm never going to get a ride. Mitchell Cohen and Mimi Urso were their names. I've been trying to get a hold of Mitchell ever since. He took me back to the dorms, dried me out, and they fed me. And I sold my guitar out there for a bus ticket. I couldn't hitchhike anymore. I got enough to get a bus ticket from Syracuse, New York, to Kenosha, Wisconsin.
I also saw you were a fan of Dave Van Ronk.
Yeah.
I read The Mayor of McDougal Street, a really wonderful book. It was an amazing time.
Yeah.
Hard to describe the energy that was coming out of people and places back then.
Oh, geez.
Folks at the time were writing what they felt, not what would sell. And what they felt was actually caring about and commenting about the world they lived in. And I've talked with a few musicians as things have heated up in our society and some cool down. The songs that are like that, it appears to me that we could use some of that passion nowadays in songwriting. How does it feel to you?
Yeah, I have to agree to some point, but another part of me sees people playing them, but are people hearing it?
Good point.
It used to be when people would protest and a group would protest, people and events they were protesting against would stop and they listen. Why are so many people against this or for this? And then do something about it, maybe change their agenda a little bit. Now what do? Bring in tanks and bring in army, and everybody's treated as a terrorist and nobody listens anymore. It's just such a wheel out of kilter that we could go on and on and on about that.
So listening is the key.
Well, that's the key. You can have all the protest songs you want to, and believe me, and as you well know, there's many of them to draw from. It's such a different world now.
I don't know. That's a good end point on that chapter of our conversation. We're sitting in the garage with Billy Krause, songwriter and singer of those songs. Heck of a guitar player. So the last time we talked was just after releasing The Last Call. And during that interview, because of some of the album content, I was lightly asking you if you were all right. You chuckled at that. And today, 3 years later, you're facing some physical challenges that we all cross our fingers we don't have to face. For those who don't know, tell your friends and fans what's going on, if you would, please, and if you don't mind me intruding.
Well, in 2013, I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma. It's a form of blood cancer. And luckily, it was caught early, and I went into treatments that led to stem cell harvesting, and it went into remission, and then it started to rear its ugly head, as they say, in January, this past January. And I went through chemo from March till just about 2.5 weeks ago. My numbers have gotten good again and back to where they should be. Been a long 5.5 months, because that one kind of beat me up a little more than the other one did, but getting there. Every day is a little better.
How's your perspective today as opposed to that first time you heard about that in 2013?
It's just that I always stay positive in anything I do in my life. My wife Margie is the same way. It's easy to think of the bad things. Think of the good things that are happening. I stay positive. I've got a good group of doctors that know what they're doing. And as Stan Lee used to say, excelsior, ever forward. You know, it is what it is. I mean, all of us are here for a short time. Be thankful of what you've got. Be thankful of the time you have. What comes next, comes next.
We kind of all look for silver linings to the clouds that might gather on any given day. I'm sure there are a bunch of personal rays of sunshine. But one that I know of is that you've been touched by so many friends in recent days and weeks, all wanting to help you pave the road or build the bridge. And most of all, just tell you how much they care. Tell me about the music fraternity that includes so many friends that you belong to.
Well, it's still a little hard to, still pretty overwhelmed. My wife and I both, she's been on this journey with me, and she has had a journey of her own, so it's not just me. It's both of us, and that's where we draw our strength from each other. We've been together 43 years, and we've gotten help and response from so many people that it was just overwhelming. And all I can say is from both of us, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you for everything you've done.
In the story that I had related to me about your situation, it was brought out that your wife has had to make just a ton of sacrifices.
We both made a promise to each other a long time ago that we're in it for the long haul. For better or for worse, the whole works. She's helped me and I've helped her. And together we're coming out the other side. We've got two great kids that help us. And as we just found out, an abundance of good friends, family, musician friends. And again, we can't say thank you enough.
It sounds as if you could have written the vows.
Well, I walked up the aisle with a guitar on my shoulder and her on my arm, so.
Did you really?
Yeah, yep.
Are there pictures?
Oh, yeah.
That's got to be a good wedding album.
I had some old relatives that were, your old relatives never take your music seriously. And they said, are you still banging on that guitar? And my wife said, that guitar has brought home the rent more times than I can count. She says, yes, he's still playing music. So she's the apple of my eye and my best friend. And there's so much I can say that I'm just without words. I love her so much that without her, I don't know what would have happened. I wouldn't be talking to you now.
Musicians, back to that fraternity, also have a marvelous way of staying in touch. It doesn't really matter how far apart you are. Once you're part of some other musician's life, it kind of appears that the bond remains. Has that sort of fascinated you over the years?
I guess I was never surprised by it. I think I've always appreciated other musicians' talents. And Eau Claire is just a treasure trove right now of talent. I mean, these young kids playing and the times that I've been accepted into the fold, so to speak, to perform with them. It's just mind-boggling. Their talents and abilities and creative powers. I've never thought of music as a competitive sport. And I don't see that in any of the musicians here. Everybody's just quick to play with everybody else, and so-and-so and so-and-so play with this band, and then they're playing another night with another group. It's just, I don't think you see that everywhere else. I really don't.
We're enjoying some distancing in Billy Krause's garage, a garage I should point out that he's very proud of. It's one of the things that I think we can be sexist about. A guy's got to have a garage.
My wife's got a greenhouse, so that's her garage.
Bingo. Now, back in 17, you talked about inspirations for songs being mostly things that you'd observed, not necessarily personal experiences. But today, as your personal experiences have again become more poignant, affecting you kind of in, I was going to say unfamiliar ways, but maybe it is kind of familiar. It just took a hiatus. Do you feel some songs coming on in a way that makes you feel like you should express kind of what's going on inside or not?
Since Last Call came out, I've kind of found myself writing more in the poetry vein than in the songwriting vein. And there's a fairly close parallel there. And I've been doing a lot of work on my laptop, not so much with my guitar. Just really, really finding enjoyment and a creativity that I knew that I had in me, but never pursued. I've got old files of some old poetry I've written years ago back in the 70s, and most of it's kind of crap. But reading over that old stuff, I could see through, after all these years of writing songs, the direction I would go with something. The cancer has brought out several verses that I'm real pleased with. I think everything's pretty much complete except for editing. So I'm hopefully having a book, a collection of poems out by early spring.
Wonderful.
Late winter, early spring.
Does it have a title?
So far the title is A Collision of Words. But that could change. You know. I was going to subtitle it The Chronicles of the Last Iron Horse, but there's only one biker poem in there, so.
Just don't make it Last Call like you did the CD.
No.
So are you finding that music and poetry is, because you've been through different forms of therapy in the last 7 years and now again in the last 8 months or so, 9 months, is it therapeutic for you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. My little back room and sit with my laptop and just...
What's things. In that back room?
Oh, you'd like to know. Not much. My computer and a little desk table to write by and my bookshelves on the wall.
Do you have a little studio where you play or do you play there?
No, I play there. They're sitting out on the deck.
Yeah, that is a nice deck. I can see it from here. I should do a play-by-play of the deck so that people have... No, I'm not going to
walk out by the chickens and sit in the chair.
Chickens?
Play to the chickens.
You have chickens?
Oh, I have chickens. I'll send you home with some eggs.
Gee whiz. One song, either one of yours or someone else's, that resonates in your life, brings you strength or peace or a comfortable view of life as it is? Anyone you can think of that, even going back to the crap of the 70s?
Boy, to nail it down to one song, I couldn't possibly do that.
Is there a song that you've written that feels as if, from this vantage point, it could have been written today? Lots of feeling behind it.
I would have to say, for the times that we live in now, probably a song that I wrote and recorded with the Sneaker Band, a song called Land of Plenty. I think we could use a song like that.
How does it go? Do you remember?
Whirlwind spinning downward direction. Voices call out with little affection. Why do so many in this land of plenty hunger? Why, if I'm growing older, do I feel younger?
No, 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 no. Downward direction, voices call out with little affection. Why do so many in this land of plenty hunger? Why, if I'm grown older, do I feel younger? Still we sing, though the ice in which we stand on grows thin. Still we sing, and we pray that the candle burns steadily brighter, not hopelessly dim. Na 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 na.
What do you see for yourself, Billy? Do you see yourself recording again? Do you see yourself writing books of poetry? Do you see yourself just sitting amongst the chickens and playing your guitar on the deck?
A little of all three, I think.
Okay.
I don't know if I'll ever record again. Never say never, as they say.
Sure.
I'm definitely enjoying writing, and I hope that, not being an academic myself, that people forgive.
Not a formal academic.
Formal academic.
You're a life academic.
But I hope people enjoy the stuff that I've written that's coming up, that I'm writing now. I called it A Collision of Words because I'm not sure if it's really poetry or what it is. But everybody I've tested it out on, so to speak, or given them samples or read for, have all went, that's good.
Yeah.
They liked it. And I like it, and I look at it the same way I look at writing songs. When I finish a song, if I like it, and I'm happy with it, it's all that matters. It may suck, but if I like it, I'm happy with the accomplishments that I've done. I'm good.
So you're not your own worst critic?
I don't think so. And my wife's been my best critic ever. There's a good example of a song that's on Last Call, a song of farewell. I wrote that in the middle of the winter, and I played it for my wife. I played it for Spark, and she said, "Oh, I like it, but where are you going to play that song?" And I thought about it. That's a good question. So I just polished it up and recorded it on the small recorder that I used for writing it. Oh, maybe another 4 months went by, and I was asked to sing at a good friend of mine's funeral. And I said, "I know just the song. This is my song of farewell. I hope every one of you wishes me well. I have to be going. There was no time to tell you that this is my song of farewell. This is my song of goodbye. One last hurrah, one last valiant try." And then it ends with, "This is my song of hello. A kiss on the cheek before turning to go. I'll be out on the porch, tell everybody you know, this is my song of hello."
There you go.
It sums it all up.
Billy, thanks so much. I appreciate you taking the time and talking about things that are close to your heart, especially watching you talk about people. It's really a thrill.
You're welcome, Al, and thank you for having me.
This is my song of goodbye. One last hurrah, one last valiant try. I said all I can say, there's no need to reply. This is my song of goodbye. Here is my song of farewell. I know every one of you wishes me well, but I have to be going. There's really no time to tell you. This is my song of farewell. Don't worry about your tomorrow and forget about yesterday's fools. And remember the game of life comes without any rules. This is my song of hello. Kiss on the cheek before turning to go. I'll wait out on the porch. Please let everyone know that this is my song of hello. I'll wait out on the porch. Please let everyone know this is my song of hello.